Welcome to Horsepower, Chrome, and Rust, covering car culture and the automotive world with Shane Osborne, Brady Wright, and Steve, the producer, Johan. Let's see what's up this week.
Hey, and here is what's happening Tuesday, January 22nd, 2019, on this episode of Horsepower, Chrome, and Rust. I am your humble, I'm the humblest guy on the planet.
Oh, yeah, wait, right.
The humble, that would be me. If you look up humble in the dictionary, it's my picture, Brady
Wright.
Right. Here, as usual.
That's right.
Now, our master mechanic and metal butcher, Shane Osborne, is taking that night off because he's trying to fit into his brand new Batman costume.
Mm-hmm.
And Steve, the producer, Johan, is here, who is working on his secret plan to build a nitrous-boosted shopping cart. Ladies and gentlemen, pictures will be on our website as soon as he actually gets the thing flying. Back to the blacktop is first. I want to see it. By the way, I posted a picture on the Facebook page of this guy who built a, it's kind of a go-kart out of two, looks like 47 Ford truck front fenders.
Wow.
And, oh, it's the coolest thing. You have to, you got to
okay,
go.
Okay, I'll be on
see,
there this
you
week.
Check it out.
Yep.
Anyway, we got other happenings in the automotive world as per usual, so what might they be?
Well, I have a load of stuff to go through, but I'm not sure if we'll get through it all. But
well,
so,
all right.
Real interesting news from the folks over at Hyundai. They are working on airbags that inflate multiple times within an accident.
Wait, within one accident?
Yeah. According to the article, as it follows, it can take just a fraction of a second for a car crash to occur, but in nearly a third of all collisions, at least one vehicle may keep moving, striking something a second time.
Yes.
These multiple collision situations can be particularly dangerous because a vehicle's airbags are typically designed to inflate once. That's right,
sure.
One time.
And then you're bopping around in there like a BB in a garbage can.
And then for only a few seconds, and then it deflates. Well,
this is interesting.
Now they are actually going after technology to provide inflation, deflation.
Hmm.
And I'm thinking, I like the idea a lot, but knowing that there's been countless millions of recalls in Tosco bags, the company is dead.
Oh, Takata.
Takata, yeah. Thank you.
I'm pretty sure that Takata will not be tapped to build these things.
No.
I'm just guessing.
And if Hyundai's tapped, that could put them into a position of real liability issues. So I'm wondering if they're going to build a separate company that's separate and apart and not connected. Therefore, if something does go wrong, and we don't want this stuff to go wrong. Look, we want them to build good
things.
It's
a great idea.
But I like the idea.
It would be smarter. I mean, I would think that Hyundai wouldn't want to have anything to do with it. I think they would have a separate vendor whose specialty is that kind of
right.
thing. Those guys would take the liability. They would build
yep.
it. It would be a subcontract. I think you'd want to have a real separation. But having said that, the technology interests me because now, I mean, as it is, replacing an airbag is pretty spendy.
Yes, it is.
I mean, those things are a grand, you know, by the time you're done fiddling
yep.
around with getting it in and out. So one that multiply inflates safely, and the testing is going to be amazing, but
yeah.
putting that in place, I'm trying to imagine, how does it vent? I mean, once you've popped the thing open, then where does all that go? Because it's got a certain amount of, there's powdery stuff inside it
right.
that prevents injury and stuff. But where does that go when they reinflate it?
Yep.
I mean, how does that look? That's fascinating. I want to know more about that.
I do,
too.
Follow
that story.
We're going to keep following it.
Yeah.
More bad news from GM. According to a message posted at Brazil plants, GM's top executive in Brazil and Argentina said after running a heavy loss during the last 3 years, operations has reached a critical moment that requires sacrifice from everyone.
Mm.
Can we say layoffs? And more close to home, reps for the UAW have stated in recent interview that they believe that they can place enough pressure on GM to reverse the plant closures in the States and in Canada, much like they've done in the past at other proposed plant closings. And you know what? I wish them luck. But with the fact that they're closing plants because they're hemorrhaging money, I don't know if that's going to happen.
Well, if you're closing plants because it's an economic move.
Yes.
How is pressure from the union going to fix the economy there? I mean, that piece of the economy. You know, the union's not going to give them any money.
Well, and here's the thing. Let's just say the GM, head of GM, is taking a pay cut. no longer getting shares from the stock market, and all the board of directors have done the same. So now you've got an extra, let's say $20 million.
40 bucks.
$20 million left over.
Yeah.
Now you don't have to lay off so many people.
Are you
but
thinking
you can't
seriously?
Do that. You can't do that. That might work for 1 year, but if they can't make sales, they're still going to have to lay people off.
But but CEOs are incentivized by sales and performance.
Let's be honest. No one's going to take that. No. That's my dream world. Okay, that's my dream world.
Okay. So now that you've woken up and the drugs have worn off.
Well, then let's move to the next one. Supra update. Now, last week we talked about the Supra and said they've been running ads on the during the playoffs and everything. Well, I watched about two or three different videos from YouTubers who went there, who have their own auto channels that I'm going to actually work to get on the show. And one of them was pointing out that it's really a BMW in disguise because it will feature BMW's ubiquitous B48 turbocharged 2.0 liter, putting out 262 horsepower, and it is paired with the ZF's 8-speed automatic transmission, and then it's also got the BMW B58 3-liter, 335 horsepower version. So basically, they're borrowing a lot from BMW platform, the drivetrain and everything, and even some of the styling cues kind of are reminiscent of some of the things. And so the observation that I have here is I think the automotive world is woken up, and they have for quite some time, that it makes more sense if we're going to come out with a sporty new car, it's going to be limited edition, rather than putting in hundreds of millions of dollars into machining and all that to build new power plants and drivetrains. Let's go over here to a close competitor who could use the business, and let's just buy their drivetrains and their engines and all that. And
And this is nothing really new.
This is nothing new.
It's been going on for decades.
I put down, here's a good example. The 80s Dodge Daytona.
Sure.
And the Mitsubishi Coronado were both the same cars.
Well, yeah, of course. And
so this has been going on forever.
I mean, most of the minivans, you know, on the Chrysler side were clones. GM and Chevy, of course, have been, you know, cloning each other for years. And it's not surprising. It is smart business.
Oh, yes, it is.
And it goes right up to today. I mean, the new generation is a little bit different, but the previous generation of the Mazda, for example, the CX-9, was also the Ford Edge, was also the Lincoln MKX.
Right.
Same car.
Was it the Isuzu?
Badged differently.
Was it the Isuzu Trooper or one of the others that had the swap-out engines from Nissan or something like that? And so this has been going on because...
Yep. And it's a good economic
plan.
It is. Sure. Saves you a lot on R&D.
Yeah, it does. And then bad news from Nissan. In another sign of potential weakness in North America automotive market, Nissan Motor Company is in the midst of tumultuous management shakeup, as
tumultuous.
We all know.
Tumultuous.
Well, the former CEO now who has stepped down, he's no longer chairman, longer. He is now, he's still on ankle, he wanted to go for ankle bracelet. And Japan's court said, nope, you're staying in jail, buddy.
Ooh.
And so... anyway, they're going to be...
that's a tough one.
They're going to cut 700 contract workers at their Canton, Mississippi plant, Nissan is.
Oh, right. Okay.
So not only are
they
cutting...
That's harsh.
God, you know, here's the thing. Everything I've been reading has pointed out that the numbers in 2019 are expected to be down from what they were in 2018.
Maybe so, yeah.
Overall, everybody's banking on the fact that they're going to be less sales, that things are kind of crunching everywhere. But on the good news, under Truck Wars comes the following. Facing challenges to the most popular product line from two automotive upstarts, Ford Motor Company. I love it. Mutters.
Sure.
Yeah, we used to call them Mutters. Anyway, Ford Motor Company says it will electrify its hugely popular F-Series pickup.
Not all the way across. They're going to make
make an F-Series electric. In order to compete with the other two, Tesla and the other one. So.
Why wouldn't you?
Anyway.
More of that to come, guaranteed. I got a brand new trivia question coming up, too, and a chat with Donnie Smith. We call him the Car Show Guy. All of that and more on Horsepower, Chrome, and Rust.
Listen and imagine. It takes 5 seconds to send a text, and for those 5 seconds, you're driving blind.
Life is worth more than a text.
Stay alive. Don't text and drive.
Visit StopTextStopWrecks.org, a message brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, Project Yellow Light, Noise, and the Ad Council.
Did you hear the news? Cartoons Magazine is back. Yep, those car-crazy comics from the past have returned in an all-new Cartoons Magazine, featuring some of your favorite artists along with a whole slew of new ones, all working together to bring you an entire magazine filled with one laugh-out-loud auto-related story after another. Bi-monthly issues are available directly through the Cartoons Magazine website at cartoonsmag.com.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Hey, car enthusiast. Are you in need of a restoration and fabrication shop that turns old steel into rolling works of art? Then look no further than E-Company Customs Hot Rods and Restorations. E-Company Customs, that's Customs with a K, is the Northwest's fastest-growing restoration and fabrication shop, providing frame-off restoration, custom mods, upholstery, rust repair, hand-done metalwork, motor work, body and paint, and a whole lot more. To book an appointment, visit them at ecompanycustoms.com or stop by their shop at 15002 Suite A, Highway 99, Linwood, Washington. E-Company Customs, providing a stress-free experience to both new and returning customers.
This is Robert Durf with the Porsche Club of America Driver Skills Program. Thank you for listening to Horsepower, Chrome, and Rust. And just want to remind everybody that it's no fun unless it smells a little bit like burnt oil and burnt rubber.
My mind's out of gear, and my heart's in overdrive. I've everything to fear. I ain't never been more alive.
Welcome back. This is the second segment of Horsepower, Chrome, and Rust, and we have a wonderful guest on with us tonight. His name is Donnie Smith, very, very well known within the motorcycling arena, the custom bike building world, and he is also owner of Donnie Smith Show Midwest Extravaganza. It used to be the Donnie Smith Bike Show, but now it's Donnie Smith Show Midwest Extravaganza, which goes on March 23rd through the 24th, St. Paul River Center in St. Paul, Minnesota. And it'll include custom bikes, custom cars, pinup girls, Budweiser girls, indoor motocross racing, swap meet, and a whole lot more. So, Donnie, how's the things going tonight?
Oh, not too bad. We're freezing to death here, but we'll be all right. You know, the motocross or the flat track racing, it is actually, that is held in another place over at the Minnesota State Fairgrounds.
Okay.
You know, this place don't have enough room for that. That takes a whole different arena. But it's the same weekend. You know, it's Friday night. And then, you know, the show doesn't start till Saturday and Sunday. So we try to spread it out so the people can get a belly full of motorcycles, you know.
And you can make a whole weekend out of it.
Yep, for sure.
That's cool.
So you first year last year with the races, and it went off really, really well.
Nice.
So,
you know, and a lot of the bigger shows are doing stuff like that. I know the Good Guys show, as it travels around, they usually have the novelty drags on Friday night, and then Saturday and Sunday are the show days. And it's a good formula. People make a whole weekend out of it.
Yeah, and it kind of breaks up the, you know, you get two different things to deal with. You know, the races, different than the bike show, and we have a monster big swap meet that is probably the biggest in the upper Midwest.
Oh, even better.
But, we got almost like four entities. We got a bike show, we have vendors, we have the swap meet, and then we have the cars. So it's it'll give you a good Saturday afternoon.
Well, now I gotta say, I spent 20 years pretty active in the Harley owners group. I was the director of a chapter locally, and we put on a ton of local bike shows. Of course, I'm familiar with your work in that arena. What made you decide to add cars to the mix?
Well, we had a space that when it freed up, we thought we'd just add on, because you know we have a event here in Minneapolis or St. Paul actually, called the Minnesota Street Rod Association, and they put on probably the second largest street rod event in the United States, and they get like close to right in the neighborhood of 13,000 cars.
That's a ton. Yeah, that's
at
great.
The fairgrounds, and it's been going on for, I don't know how many years, like probably 20, 30 years they've been doing it. And it's owned by this car club called the Minnesota Street Rod Association, and it is unbelievable. I mean, it's just anything and anything you can think of is there. They don't have anything newer than I think the newest car you can have is a 64. And the reason they do that is so it don't get all loaded up with Mustangs.
yeah. So that makes perfect sense.
But it's a great event. So we just thought, it's a natural. There's lots of cars around, and it was a slow start building, and then the World of Wheels used to be here, and they had a big setup, and then they started moving around, and pretty soon they lost the crowd because they changed venues, and then all at once they're going to come in, and we got this new dome where they had the Super Bowl last year.
Right, right.
Funny-looking thing. And they tried to put it on in there, but it was overly expensive, and it just doesn't lend itself to be that kind of an event. And so they lasted 2 years, and our car happened to be the same weekend as our show. And so we kind of were splitting the cars. Even if there's a lot of cars around here, people, the weather ain't real nice, they won't come to the show because a lot of them don't have trailers.
Right, right.
You know, and they don't want to get them dirty. But, it's been a good addition. People enjoy it. There's always a lot of people up there looking. We have some wonderful cars. We take just about everything that'll come in. And we have a really good following of Rat Rods, which is a thing they got around here called the Frankensteiners. And they put on a big event. I don't know the numbers on that, but it's had to move from one fairground to a bigger fairground.
It's kind of amazing. Over the last probably, five, maybe 10 years, the whole rat rod phenomenon used to be kind of a backyard, build it with whatever had laying around kind of a deal, but it's really taken off. There's tons and tons and tons of people doing that because you can build a perfectly good, fun, creative, drivable car for way under 10 grand for the most part. And, that's within the reach of just about everybody. Not everybody can afford a Trailer Queen show car.
Exactly. Well, and, a lot of times when you build them, it's the bodywork and the paint that just, a lot of it you can, it get fairly reasonable. I mean, nothing's cheap. Trust me. I've built bikes for I don't know how many years. It just never is a cheap move, But, our show has been phenomenal. Our Saturdays, it's almost like you can't get another person in there on Saturdays.
Nice. Well, that's what you want.
Yeah. That's what we want.
You want to sell out of T-shirts.
Yep. You're darn right. That's the name of the game, And it, one of the problems we got lots of vendors that want to be in the show, and you can only, we try to keep as much of a balance of the custom bikes there. So there's usually probably in the neighborhood of 180 to 200 custom bikes. And some are like vendors that, bring in bikes. And then we have a bagger class and a pro class. And then we just take on like stockers, not too many stock bikes. Surprisingly, like Dave Perowitz, who is, a very dear friend of mine, he just stayed here a week ago. A friend of ours passed away, a tattoo guy, and Dave was big into that.
Yeah.
And he said, I go to all kinds of shows up and down the Midwest or up East Coast. He said, none of them compare the quality of bike that you have. He said, they might have 10 bikes that are nice and the rest of it's just junk. And he said, I can't hardly pick 10 bikes out of here that I don't think belong here,
That's high praise.
It is. And, because we always think that, you read all this stuff in the magazines and whatever, and then you're going like, God, how do they get this 30 and 40,000 people? And finally we found out that it don't happen.
Well, there's a big difference between buying a bunch of bolt-on stuff from Kuryokan or whoever else and making your stuff. There's a huge difference. And a lot of people don't realize what it takes to build a custom bike. Same thing with cars. You can buy stuff, but making it, that's a whole other level of skill.
Well, when you get into to fabrication, when you're sheet metal fabrication, when you're bending things, when you look at the best of the builders, be it cars or bikes, it becomes a lot of hand fabrication, and yeah, you can get a frame off of a parts company, but then you're like, well, I want to roll the fender, I want to build my own tank. Now you're adding a lot of time and a lot of craftsmanship, which is what the pricing you're paying for. So that kind of leads me into this, Donnie. I want to step back a little bit, because as much as most of the people that listen to the show are car-oriented, they all enjoy a little bit of history, and motorcycling is going right along with it. So let's step back in time. When did you start building custom bikes for a living? And if I understand right, you weren't doing bikes to begin with. You had something to do with cars. So talk to us about that.
Well, I left the farm in 1961. I grew up on a farm, and I come to the cities, and of course, you know, I was a gearhead, you know, so me and a handful of my friends moved down here. So Minnesota had a beautiful drag strip, and it had another little drag strip that was a decent strip, but this one they had, you know, a quarter-mile track had a half-mile shutdown.
Well, hold on.
Really great,
wow. Hold on. I just realized I am running up against the clock, and I need to give...
That's all right. Hold that thought. We'll do it when we come back around.
We'll be right back, and I'm looking to hear about the quarter mile with a half-mile shutdown. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. You'd be moving if you needed that. Stay right here. We got more with Donnie Smith. We got another story from the old Car Nut books, that and more on Horsepower Chrome and Rust.
Okay, forest animals, kids are coming to the forest, and it's up to us to make their visit a good one. Sparrow, have you practiced the most popular bird songs for the year?
Of course.
Catchy. I like it. River, how's the temperature?
It's a refreshing 52 degrees, man.
I love it. Turtle.
He's not here yet, man.
He's late every morning. Okay. Squirrel.
The forest has been preparing just for you. To learn more about cool things to do in the forest, visit discovertheforest.org. Brought to you by the U.S. Forest Service and the Ad Council.
Attention men under the age of 35. You know what really impresses the ladies? When a guy has a few drinks and later gets pulled over for buzz driving. That could cost you around $10,000 in fines, legal fees, and increased insurance rates. There goes let's grab dinner and a movie. Oh, I know. You drive more carefully when you're buzzed. You've proven that hundreds of times. A woman admires that kind of confidence. And you've practiced how to speak if a cop does pull you over. Slowly, clearly, and politely, like, good evening, officer. A woman admires that kind of foresight. And what woman doesn't find it adorable that you call it buzzed even though the law calls it drunk? You could kiss $10,000 goodbye, along with any chance of having a girlfriend. Because nothing says, I'm a catch, more than a guy who lives in his parents' basement and calls it my place.
Buzzed, busted, and broke. Because buzz driving is drunk driving. A message from the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration.
More Horsepower Chrome and Rust after these messages.
Looking for a job worth talking about? Teaching is creative, collaborative, and intellectually challenging. See why teachers have better work stories at teachdfw.org and learn more about becoming a teacher.
1 in 7 Americans will struggle with addiction during their lifetime. Want to know how you can help? Go to heretolisten.com for tips and tools to help turn addiction around.
Hello, this is Zach with Cascade Campers. You're listening to Horsepower Chrome and Rust.
Back in Vehicle City. Yes, we are back in Vehicle City, and we are in the third segment of the Horsepower Chrome and Rust Show, and we've got Donnie Smith, custom bike builder and owner of Donnie Smith Show Midwest Extravaganza. Hey, and for more information, go over to DonnieSmithBikeShow.com. You'll find out more about it. It's March 23rd and 24th out there in St. Paul River Center, St. Paul, Minnesota. And Donnie, we were just left off with you telling us about... You were attracted to that area because there was a really nice drag strip, and it had a quarter-mile run with a half-mile runoff.
Really slow back in the
3 weeks later.
So pick it up there.
Yeah, anyway, us guys, you know, we're from western Minnesota, farm country, and we come down here, and we started hanging at the drag strip, and the couple of my buddies there along. They had a pair, the two brothers, they had a 57 Chevy, and so did I. So we'd go out and race a little bit, and then I got a little bit involved. My uncle had a bike, and I would help him with that a little bit, mostly because I had a driver's license and he didn't. So I would drive him out to the track. And then I got involved in being another friend of mine from back home, built a 40 Willis B-gas supercharged coupe, and the coupe and sedan deal, the old days of the gases.
Right.
So we ran that for about 2 years, and then it broke a front spring going through the lights at about 120, and then it tumbled, and of course I got kind of beat up in there. So then we built an.
We used to call those educational experiences.
Yeah, exactly. So we decided we weren't going fast enough, so then we built an A-gas supercharge.
There you go.
We found a Willis pickup, and that other car went like probably a 10-20, 121 or 2, as I remember.
Yeah, that's respectable.
We built this Willis pickup that had an older Hemi in it, and that one we run that for 2 years, I think, and it ran 938-153 back in '67.
Moving.
Then Uncle Sam decided he needed me for a couple of years so that I get some machine gun fodder for NAMM, but I didn't go to NAMM. I went to Germany. Anyway, I got through that and come back, and gases were dead and funny cars were in, so we built a 70 CUDA funny car with an early Hemi in it, and I don't really even remember how fast that one went. I think it maybe was, texting me now, in the low eights or something like that. It was an all right car, you know. I mean, we didn't have the big money at that time, and then we run that 2 years and sold it, and then we built the Mustang. And in the meantime, the motorcycle stuff in 1970, my uncle brought over a brand new 70 Sportster, and he had an AE&E Springer. And he says, I want the frame raked. And we're farm kids. A rake is something you do with hay. You know? And we're going, and he goes, no, you take this thing and you tilt it out here and you put that fork on. And we go, okay, because we had a Heliarc, which is like a guy having a five-axis CNC in his garage.
Oh,
nowadays,
yeah.
You know?
Oh, yeah.
And so one Sunday we're in there with them, and we cut this thing all up and get it squared away. And so then all at once, you know, me and my brother both rode, and we're going, oh, hell, we can do that to our bikes, you know. So then you couldn't get Springers back then, Dave. So we go, well, we build race cars, we can build Springers.
There you go.
So we got after that and built some Springers. And then the word got out. My uncle belonged to a club. And pretty soon them guys are bringing their frames over, and then other people, you know, and so we're like, we all three had full-time jobs, and we'd come back and probably work anywhere from 4 to 6 hours that night on making stuff and doing frames and that, and so we'd have money for the race car. Pretty soon it just started to explode on us, you know, and of course, hate to say this over the air, but we were doing everything for cash and, you know, buying parts for the race car.
Well, sure.
Oh, yeah.
My one buddy says, you need to get a set of books going. He said, you need to go see an accountant. So we went and seen the accountant, and after a year, he said, you know, if you got rid of that race car, you could make a living off these bikes. We go, but we're racers. He goes, no, you're bike builders now, you know, so here I am, you know. We were calling Smith and Fetro. After he told us that, from the three of us, we went to 15 employees in about 2 years.
Wow. You know, you talked about building those frames back in the day. I got to tell you a real quick story. In 1971, I decided I wanted to build a chopper, and I bought a police bike from the Seattle Police Department. It was a shovel head. And after I stripped the thing down, I knew I wanted to rake the thing and extend the front end. And the guys down at Street Choppers, you know, AEE and everything, I knew about that stuff, but I couldn't afford any of it. So I went to my buddy who was a welder, and I said, we got to rake this thing out. So we made two cuts, top and bottom of the neck. And we took a big piece of steel bar and heated up the neck, bent it out until it looked good. And then we gusseted the whole dang thing together and put a 16 over front end on it. And, you know, we never wrote a plan. We never took a measurement. We just did it by eyeball. And doggone if that thing didn't track like it was on rails. I can't imagine, you know, driving it now. But that's what you did back in the day.
Oh, yeah. You know, talking about that same program, we sold this guy, belonged to another club in St. Paul. sold him a 16 over, which seemed to be the popular one at the time.
Yeah.
And he called me up and he said, the front end won't go, I can't get it on my bike. I said, what do you mean you can't get it on? You put the bearings on, you slide it up. Nope, won't go through. Something's wrong with the front end. I said, all right, I'll come over after. As soon as I get done with work here, I'll run over there. So I go over there and I walk in, and there's about four or five club members in there, you know, and they're all, you know, good guys at the, you know, and so I go over, and whoever did it the, not the way you did it. You did it right. What they did is they cut it about half up, and then they heated it and bent it out, and what they did is they, instead of the round neck hole in the thing, it's shaped like a D.
Now it's square, yeah.
And so somehow he hammers the cups in it, and then I said, well, look at this hole. You know, because, you know, you put a one-inch stem.
Yeah, the stem won't go in there.
Like,
yeah.
An inch and a quarter, so you only got an eighth inch around. And he goes, then all at once there was some swearing about some guy. That, rah, rah. I said, are we okay? Yep. And so I left, you know.
Yeah.
I don't know whatever they did to fix it. But back in the day, we used to get people would bring stuff in, and you're going, you know, they. Yeah, hard to explain, but
yeah,
we get it fixed up for them. We, you know, we got it fixed.
Well, worst comes to worst, you just weld a whole new neck on there, I guess. I mean,
that's what we did. The first bike I did, we had cut up the old original Sportster casting.
Oh, right, yeah.
And it made, you know, I had like a 20 over springer on that one. And
jeez.
Then my brother,
that's gutsy.
Fetra was a machinist, and he goes, you know, that's a lot of work farting around with that casting. So he went and machined a whole front section, and you know, and then we just made the down tubes meet up to it, you know,
right.
And then pretty soon, once people seen that, we had, you know, we
now
we
you're good had, to go.
We had one time we did, we had like a pile of probably 17 Sportster frames in a pile, and I got a book from 1975, and I counted to it in 1975. By then, we had extra help, and we had a guy that all he did was front section frames. We did 275 of them in 1975.
Oh, jeez.
Wow.
After a while, you get tired of working on those iron heads, though, don't you? I mean.
Yeah. You know, I still have that thing about, you know, I was big in electric starts, you know, but even then,
yeah.
You know, even nowadays when I go to hit the, you know, the button or the key on the bike, I'm going, God, start, you know. In them days, there was about
that's right.
50 jams.
Oh, yeah.
But
I rode one for a year that had a cracked coil, and it started about the second hit every time. I was amazed.
Wow.
I was amazed. And we live in a wet climate up here, too. But,
you know,
they just held together.
I had a 78 Yamaha Twin special, and it was a kickstart.
We're not going to hold that against you.
No,
right.
It was my first bike.
I was going to say. Well, he's a brave soul.
Say that on the air.
Yeah, but I'd kickstart that thing, and boy, there were times when 10, 11, 12, it got going. It was, and you had the brushes and the points, and we swapping out those brushes. I had an extra pair with me, and wherever I went, I had, because they would go bad. You just didn't know when they were going to go bad. So people don't know that bikes later on,
it
like
could
today,
have been worse. Could have been British.
Yeah. Yeah, well.
Yeah, I was going to say that. Yeah,
there's always.
The Prince of Darkness.
That's right. Yeah, Lucas. Lucas the Prince
that's
of Darkness.
Right. The English people drink warm beer. They got Lucas refrigerator.
That's right. That's exactly right.
I wondered why they drank warm beer.
Yeah.
Well, now. That started back in the 70s, and you really built up yourself you really got into doing your own custom bikes, too, as well, and you built up a great reputation for yourself. And back in that day, much like custom car builders, there was a small cadre of you guys, wasn't there, of the bike builders in out there in that
area?
You
know what? You know, there was, you know, like it is nowadays, there's a lot of hit and miss people, and that's just part of the sport. I'm not picking on anybody, but, you know, the guy that I really say that probably put me and Dave Perowitz on the map was a guy named Bob Clark, had Street Chopper.
Yep, absolutely.
You know, he was the editor, and he came to Sturgis, and what his plan was, he was the editor, and his plan was, you know, West Coast is easy for them because you just go drive over in a parking lot and there's something
sure.
Sitting there to shoot. But now he wanted to be a Midwest and East Coast. So he ended up, you know, getting talking to people and said, you got to go find Donnie Smith. So he ends up finding me and shooting a bike. And, you know, I mean, I'm, you know, in seventh heaven, I'm going to be in the magazine, you know, and We had been in a magazine before with Randy Smith from Custom Cycle Engineering. I don't know if you remember him.
Yeah, that's a name out of the past.
He's the first guy that shot us, and he's the first one that kind of clued us in. But he was up here in, I think, 73 or 4, and, you know, we met him in Bowling Green, and he shot some of our bikes, and he said, God, you guys got some nice bikes. So we got all kinds of them in Minnesota. And he said, well, you know what, I'm coming up. I said, you can crash at our house. So he came up, and, you know, he shot the shop, and he shot, you know, 5 bikes of ours. And so we're out having burgers and a beer, and we're talking to some girls, and one girl says, it must be really cool when you can take your hobby and make a living out of it. He says, you take your hobby and make a living out of it, it is no longer your hobby.
At first,
I went like, what? You know, that sounds kind of funny. But later on, I still like to ride, but I, you know, like my brother, who is no longer part of the industry, he, you know, got into doing rental property and stuff like that. But he rides every night. I like to ride on weekends, and I ride maybe one time during the week. But,
yeah,
you know, you work 8-10 hours on bikes, and then you want to come home and jump on a bike, you know.
Yeah,
but,
it's true. It's true.
Well, and I want to segue back in. So when did you start the bike show, which is now the auto show, bike show extravaganza?
The multi-vehicle show.
Yeah.
You know, you said I'm not the owner, I'm the poster child, but Neil Ryan owns it, and him and I are partners in the show.
Very good.
But it's like, I think this will be our 17th year. Well, you know what? When I was 75, we had it 15 years, and I'll be 77. So this will be our 77th year of us owning it. It's an old J&P show.
Okay, got it.
Got handed around, and
sure.
And it's when the guy that owned the Chicago show, this I can't think of his name right now, but anyway, he was struggling up here, and then Neil had talked to me, and I said, boy, these shows, they seem to not make it up here. And he says, I think with your name, we can do it. And, you know, it was just the right time because, you know, we got into it, and he did it. You know, Neil is a very, very good promoter. He knows, you know, he's good at it. And between me having my history of knowing, you know, understanding things, we've really put it together. And it, I mean, our show is phenomenal. It's, if you've never been there, shame on you.
All right, we'll take that. I'm gonna make a pilgrimage out there and see if I can do it.
Yeah, that would be great.
Is the snow gonna be melted by March? Seriously,
you know,
come on.
There's hardly you know, snow here right now in the metropolitan area.
Really,
we have not had a foot of snow. Everything goes north of us or south of us, and you know, I mean, everything looks gray because of, you know, the snow is just kind of dirty looking now.
Yeah,
you know? It's cold. It's cold, you know, and stuff like that. But, I mean, we just have not had any snow. They claim in the next week we're supposed to be having some coming our way. But
every time
they tell us that, we get 1-2 inches, you know.
Well, I know how that story goes because I got family in Montana, and I've been there and North Dakota. I know what you're talking about. It's not bad snow. It's only 8-9 feet. I know how that works.
Yeah. Well, you know, just about 5 days ago, a town that's maybe, 100 miles from here, 18 inches.
Yeah.
We didn't even get a dusting.
You skated, huh?
Well, you know, Donnie, we're getting towards the end of our time with you, and I just want to say thanks so much for being on with us, and we'd loved, and, you know, folks, if you're out in the Minnesota area, please go to DonnieSmithBikeShow.com and go visit it. If you're a car lover or a bike lover or both, check it out. It's a wonderful place to go. Donnie will be hanging around. I'm sure you can find out where he's at and go shake his hand, say
thanks.
And
hey, Donnie, stay with us after the break here because we want to make sure we get all the information from you so we can put it up on our website and promote the show that way. So don't go away even though we're going to say goodbye.
Yeah.
Okay. No, I'll hang in here.
All right.
Well, thank you so much, Donnie, for being on with us. And, folks, we're going to be right back with more of the show. We got a great car show, car nut book.
That's right.
Story coming up and
a
whole lot more. So stick with us. Be right back with more of the Horsepower Chrome and Rust.
listen, as a hiring manager, I've got to tell you, the best job candidate isn't always the typical candidate. Sometimes they're a grad of life.
Meet the grads of life. Young adults of unique determination and experience. An ideal fit for your company in an entry-level position, internship, or mentorship. They might not have every qualification you typically look for, but they're exactly who your company needs.
Sometimes the best candidates aren't the ones you're used to.
Go to gradsoflife.org to learn how to find, cultivate, and train this great pool of untapped talent.
Hey, car enthusiast, are you in need of a restoration and fabrication shop that turns old steel into rolling works of art? Then look no further than E-Company Customs Hot Rods and Restorations. E-Company Customs, that's Customs with a K, is the Northwest's fastest-growing restoration and fabrication shop, providing frame-off restoration, custom mods, upholstery, rust repair, hand-done metalwork, motor work, body and paint, and a whole lot more. To book an appointment, visit them at ecompanycustoms.com or stop by their shop at 15002 Suite A, Highway 99, Linwood, Washington. E-Company Customs, providing a stress-free experience to both new and returning customers.
Stick around. We'll be back after these words.
When it comes to saving money, don't act like a baby.
Goo goo gaga.
Be the boss and make a budget.
I'm the boss, baby.
You're the boss of me.
I am the boss of you.
Are not.
M2.
Are not.
M2.
Need a little help?
Aren't you going to do any work?
I'm very busy delegating.
Create a personalized savings plan.
We can share.
You obviously didn't go to business school.
And get other tools and tips at feedthepig.org. Brought to you by the American Institute of CPAs.
This is Elton Roundhill and Shane Osborne with E-Company Customs in Linwood, Washington. You're listening to Horsepower Chrome and Rust.
This is Cody with Bow Wow Air Cooled. You're listening to Horsepower Chrome and Rust.
This is Robert with Bonbrenner Motorsport. You're listening to Horsepower Chrome and Rust.
It spits gasoline. What? This is the fourth segment of the show. This is Cars Confidential. We share all kinds of hot rod stories, and whoa, do we have a good hot rod story this time. This is from one of the old Car Nut books. In fact, it is the original old Car Nut book.
How old is it?
How old is the book, or how old is the story?
Well,
I don't know. This is from the first one, so this is like, I guess, 4 years old now?
Yeah.
Yeah, about that. The story may be older. The story is one by Larry Brooks, and it's called Why I Love White Cars. So, you know how sometimes you just seem to click with somebody or something that just seems to go so natural for you? I've felt this many times in my life. I've had a love affair with cars since I first knew what they were. I didn't play or care at all for sports. As a kid, I saved my allowance and spent every penny of it on auto-related items. I bought Hot Rod and Carcraft magazines religiously. I bought model cars, and I built them. When I would force myself to save my money long enough, I'd purchase a factory promotional model car. Now, later in life, as I began purchasing real cars, I noticed a trend developing in my preferences, mostly in the color. It wasn't intentional by any means. It just occurred on its own, or so I thought. That color was white, and after I bought my first white car, I noticed I just enjoyed sitting and looking at that car. I did this much more than the other cars I'd owned, and finally realized it was because of the color. I noticed the lines of the car seemed to look better when finished with white paint. When the car was clean, well, it really looked clean. I felt that the chrome accents and the chrome wheels on the car truly stood out on a background of white paint. I noticed this more and more as I bought more white cars. Well, it was becoming an obsession. I've owned probably 20 or more white cars in my time. Relatives and friends and co-workers alike have all asked me at one time or another why I like white cars so much. And I always tell them the reasons stated above, but I knew in the back of my mind there was more to it than that. However, for many years, I just couldn't put my finger on it. Then one day I had an epiphany. If you don't know the definition of that word, look it up. It has a pretty strong bearing on the outcome of this story. In 1957, when I was 5 years old, already a huge car lover, my father decided to purchase a new family vehicle. He left home one day to search out his dream car. Apparently impressed by the success the Pontiacs were having in NASCAR racing that year, he came home later that day with a 57 Pontiac Star Chief two-door hardtop. It was the complete opposite of the car he had driven to the dealership, a 51 Buick Special two-door sedan that was a dark green with gray interior and black wall tires. It was a drab and frumpy car, even in my five-year-old mind. However, this 57 Star Chief was as beautiful a car as I had ever seen in my short life. It had wide white wall tires, spinner hubcaps, fender skirts, a rear antenna, and a funny-looking triangular sort of emblem on the front fenders. I asked my dad what that was, and he said it stood for the tri-power engine in the car. I remember his lifting the hood, telling me to look under the huge air cleaner at the three carburetors. And I did look, but I didn't understand what tri-power was. He told me that was what made the Pontiacs so fast. And that car was truly a modern looking compared to the old Buick he'd had, and it was white. It had a dark red spear down the side, and the leather interior was dark red and white, and I'd never had a car affect me like that one did. Then we rode around in it, and I genuinely felt special. I remember what a brilliant, sunny day it was in Atlanta, Georgia on that afternoon. The weather was warm, and we had all four windows down. I absolutely loved it, and I was excited that it was about to be ours. After my dad, mom, sister, and I arrived back home in it, my dad told my mother he was going to go back and try to make a deal with him on this car. My mother gave her approval, and off he went. And he came back a couple of hours later in a new 57 Pontiac. But it wasn't that Star Chief. It was a Chieftain, two-door hardtop with wide white walls and small hubcaps. Its main color was aqua with a white side spear, and it didn't have the tri-power. I remember the huge letdown I experienced even at that age. He said he couldn't afford the Star Chief, so he had to go with the Chieftain. It was really a bummer. That white Star Chief had been burned into my mind, and obviously still is to this day. The next big experience for me was in 1959. By then, we'd moved to Mobile, Alabama. My dad was the manager of an insurance agency there. One evening after supper, one of his agents came by our house to show us his new car. It was a 59 Chevy Impala, two-door hardtop with wide white wall tires, spinner hubcaps, fender skirts, dual rear antennas, and a pair of crossed flags above a chrome V emblem on the hood. The agent asked my dad if he knew what the crossed flags indicated. He said he did not. Neither did I. So he opened the hood, and I saw massive orange valve covers with a black air cleaner above them. The man told us to look under the air cleaner, and I noticed this car had three carburetors, too. Aha! Suddenly, all the memories of that 57 Star Chief came flooding back into my young but impressionable mind. Guess what color that Impala was?
White.
Yep, it was white.
White.
It had a bright turquoise interior. He had all four windows down, and this car was even more beautiful than that Star Chief had been. Being a proud new owner, he asked if we'd like to take a ride in it, and I remember saying, well, yeah! They both laughed at that, and we got in the car. Then more magic happened. He started the engine, and the exhaust reverberated through the whole body of the car. As we proceeded down the street, it roared. My dad asked about the smooth rumble, and the guy told us he'd taken it to an exhaust shop as soon as he bought it and had him install new glass pack mufflers.
Oh, yes.
Remember glass packs? I was really in heaven, proud to just be seen in that car, and it became emblazoned in my tender young mind. I remember asking my dad sometime after that if we could get a car like that, and he gave me a stern no. I honestly believe this is the reason I love white cars so much now, and I have for so many years. I own six cars, and four of them are white. I can find no other reason for my absolute obsession with this wonderful hue for an automobile other than the imprint was left on my young and impressionable mind. Now, when the time comes that I'm done obsessing with cars, it'll be because my soul has passed from this earth, and I hope when that time comes, I'll be carried to my final destination in a white funeral hearse.
Yes.
White cars. I tell you, you know, the first car that I, well, it's not the first car I remember, but the first cool car my folks ever bought. My dad was a big guy for sedans.
Right.
But in 1963, he bought a brand new Chevy Impala SS with bucket seats and a floor shift. It was like the car that year. And it was white with the turquoise interior.
Yes.
And it had a 283 and a Powerglide transmission. You know, it was the car for that year.
Right.
And I still remember that car to this day. I drove it until it had 126,000 miles on it. It was the one I took my driver's test in. And I wish that I had that car today. I understand white cars.
I swear, my neighbor, Scott McCallum, he was a couple of years older, 2 or 3 years older than I was, maybe 4 years older than I was. Big family, lived across the street. He bought himself a 63 white Impala.
Oh, yeah.
Now, I don't know if it was an SS, but it had the 283 in it, and this was during the 70s.
Well, if it had a console and bucket seats, it was the SS.
Well, I just remember it parked there every day.
Yeah.
I didn't spend any time going over and pawing through it, but I just remember white 63 Impala sitting there. And yes, in those Impalas, the white Impala look nice. They look really nice.
Gorgeous cars. You know,
white is a very unique color on a car.
It's like black. It shows everything.
It does. Our Ford Taurus shows everything. But you know, when it's cleaned up, it shows the lines better than anything else.
Yeah.
It really does.
Yep. It's true. It's true.
That is cool. Now, interestingly enough, my father, when I was a little kid, probably 5 years old, my dad had a Mercury Comet station wagon.
Oh, yeah. Nice.
And I remember going to the drive-in movie and sitting in the back and sleeping back there. And then in 65, he bought himself, our family, a four-door Mercury. I think it might have been a Comet. And it was white as well. So the two
cars, I remember white. Yeah.
And then in 1970, he ended up getting himself a great big Dodge Polaris station wagon, root beer brown or that close to that.
Yes.
Big brute of a car. And then in 71, he bought the Mazda 1800 because by that time, my mom needed a car to get us around and he needed his own. And that's when he got the Mazda 1800.
Well, see, now when I took the 63 Chevy over from the family, I got to drive it. You know, it was became my car.
Yeah.
My old man at that point was driving a 63 Riviera, which was the company car that, you know, he was driving.
Oh, good.
But he had to buy a new car for my mom because that was it. So I thought, hey, I got the best end of this deal, man. I got the Impala. I got the SS.
Yep.
He went out and bought a 1970 Monte Carlo silver. It was gorgeous. And I went, oh, how could I not? Hey, the trivia question's coming up. We got to hit it next week's show. Thanks to David Dickinson for letting us play with the old Car Nut books. Stick around. We'll be back. You're into cars, you love a good time, and you'd rather build it than buy it. You might just love the Rat Bastards. The Rat Bastards Car Club is a family-oriented, non-profit organization. We believe in 1969 and older, in the rough is enough, real steel and iron, old-school, traditional hot rods and rat rods. We get together, have fun, help each other, and love to drive them. Your build is our build, because that's the way car clubs are supposed to be. The Rat Bastards are a new class of old-school, and our signature event is the Infestation every July. Find us at a cruise in all over the Puget Sound and on the Rat Bastards Car Club page on Facebook.
Hey all, I'm Blake Shelton. I love that country music connects people all over this great nation, but unfortunately so does something else, childhood hunger. 15 million children struggle with hunger in America. That's why the Feeding America nationwide network of food banks works to rescue our surplus food to help provide billions of meals to families in need across the country. Join the fight against hunger at feedingamerica.org. Together, we can solve hunger. Together, we're feeding America.
Did you hear the news? Cartoons Magazine is back. Yep, those car-crazy comics from the past have returned in an all-new Cartoons Magazine, featuring some of your favorite artists along with a whole slew of new ones, all working together to bring you an entire magazine filled with one laugh-out-loud auto-related story after another. Bi-monthly issues are available directly through the Cartoons Magazine website at cartoonsmag.com.
In 95, I helped tow your trailer. And in 09, it was sparks from me, your chains, dragging behind your truck that accidentally started a wildfire.
Spark a change, not a wildfire.
I'm jumping in with my clothes on.
Most party fouls are pretty dumb, but if you decide to drink and drive underage, you could lose your license and your freedom. Learn more at ultimatepartyfoul.org. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
This is Donnie Smith. You've been listening to Horsepower, Chrome, and Rust. Enjoy yourself.
Help us if you can. You're an El Camino. El Camino man. Only you can understand.
Only Steve can understand.
Yes.
Being an El Camino man. It's the fifth and final segment of the show. This is Around the Wheel, where, as usual, we talk about all kinds of events and rallies, and we should plug Donnie Smith's Midwest show in March. What is it, 28th and 29th?
23-24.
23-24, yep.
In March,
if you're in
St. Paul, Minnesota,
you can go there, and that would be a good one. But around here in the Northwest, there are all kinds of things coming up. The club, not the club, but the car show scene is really starting to heat up. All of the venues are starting to promote their shows. There's just going to be a ton of them. Portland Roadster Show is coming up. We can talk about that too. But before we do any of that, we have a trivia question. Last week, we asked what car first put the horn button in the center of the wheel. Lots of people had horns. Of course, they had them before that. But when they finally put the electric horns in cars, they settled on the steering wheel, in the center steering wheel, to put it. And what was the car that was first to put that horn button in the center of the steering wheel? And the car was the 1915. 1915. It was the Scripps Booth Model C. It was also the first one with electric door latches. The first one, 1915.
1915. No way.
Isn't that something? I know that this is it, because we actually had a winner. I got a Facebook messenger from a young lady named Tressie Conover, and she said, I had to Google this to find it. I appreciate your honesty, Tressie. Nobody expects these things to be stuck in your head. You'd be a really boring
1915.
Person. 1915. Come on.
Oh, come on. When did cars get invented? I mean, that's not that long. And they
1885.
I know.
Benz.
That's 20 years. And they were already putting electric car locks.
30 years, but still. Yeah, I mean, it's true.
You said 1915. Yeah. And
1885.
Oh, 85, okay.
Yeah. Benz was, yeah.
I thought
but
they were
still,
later than that, but
still,
anyway.
Yeah, I mean, it's crazy. So anyway, good on Tressie. She gets the gold-plated chrome-inlaid bucket of horsepower chrome and rust barn fine
Jeez.
Dust. And we'll be shipping that out by donkey shortly so that she can have that.
Mule.
You too could win one if you...
A burrow.
That's right. If you possibly could have come up with the answer to this week's trivia question, which is, this is a good one. Donnie was talking about fast cars and some of the speeds that he's done. What was the U.S. production car? What U.S. production car has the quickest 0 to 60 mile an hour time? Not the speed, but the time.
Okay.
What U.S. production car is the quickest? Now, I'm going to tell you before you go with this, it's a trick question. There are two answers. But I'll accept either one of them. You can get to us by email at contactus@horsepowerchromeandrust.com. You can send us a text or a message through Facebook if you like. You could even call us on the phone that I'm not going to give you the number to. But
no.
You seriously could. No matter how you do it. You
Unless you're a past guest.
Well,
you can call me.
Everybody knows our number. Anyway, you could do that. And you too, yes, you too could win the coveted bucket of horsepower chrome and rust barn find dust, which if you sprinkle it on your vehicle, of course, as we well know, will quadruple the value because people think you found it in a barn. Or it's just really dirty, one of the two.
Well, and speaking of really dirty barn finds, I found about 3 or 4 or 5 different shows on YouTube all featuring guys that do this. And I'm going to contact a number of them and get them on our show. Because,
oh, you mean barn find stuff?
Yes.
Oh, cool. Yeah, let's
And they're
do
showing
that.
These... They're just, showing, well, they're
just don't get the guys from
America. I haven't driven this thing for 40 years, and it's a 67, blah, 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 and it's a 72, blah, blah, blah.
We should
and
talk
the next
to
thing
them.
You know, they're pulling them out, they're cleaning them off, and you're like,
we
Holy
should talk to
smoke.
These guys and find out how much more they think their car is worth because it's been all over the net.
I know.
You know?
I know. So
unfortunately,
I'm
finding cars in a barn used to be a good deal. Like you could go by some guy's, some farmer's field and say, hey, I'll give you $50. Now, oh, you'll give me $18,000, you know?
Well, they
everybody
know.
Thinks their car is worth, you know, elephant money because Barrett Jackson says so.
Well, yeah. And a lot of it happens to be that people are attached to these things and won't let them go.
They are. Hey, it's worth what you pay for it, you know? The music's our cue. We're hitting the gas until next week. Thanks to Donnie Smith for stopping by. Thank you for liking and following our website and our Facebook page. For Shane Osborne and Steve Johann, I'm Brady Wright saying keep your eyes on the road, your hands on the wheel, and your foot right there on the floor. Next week, we'll crank up another edition of Horsepower, Chrome, and Rust.